Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the April 17th reading of The Environment, a compilation of articles from the magazine of the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy magazine, and Mother Earth News. My name is John. Today we'll read the following two main articles from the magazine of the Sierra Club. Love for the outdoors is infectious. Helping others get outside is a gift that pays itself forward. Written by Ben Jealous. Also from the magazine of the Sierra Club, this proposed law will be a boon for outdoor recreation. Congress considers the largest outdoors package of President Biden's term. This was written by Lindsay Botts. And with any remaining time, we'll jump over to Mother Earth News for this article, Territorial Space on Public Highways, Who Owns the Road? Written by Carlton Reed. And here we go with our first article from the magazine of Sierra Club, Love for the Outdoors is Infectious, written by Ben Jealous. When we see a 75-year-old white man out in the woods with a group of black and brown kids from low-income neighborhoods teaching them about nature, few of us assume he is there because that is where he feels most comfortable. Probably even fewer of us assume many of those kids look just like the ones he grew up with in public housing projects more than 60 years ago. Rocky Milburn grew up as one of the few white kids in a mostly black public housing development in southern Indiana. His family was very poor. They were still poor when they moved into an old farmhouse in the country. That was where Milburn fell in love with the outdoors. Even though his parents struggled financially, perhaps even worse than when they lived in the projects, Milburn did not care. "We lived right across the street from a creek," Milburn says, pronouncing it crick, "and I spent my days running the fields. You can kind of say it was my drug at the time." For more than 25 years, Milburn has been an outings leader with the Sierra Club's Inspiring Connections Outdoors, ICO, program in Tampa, Florida. The program takes youths from underserved communities on outings such as camping and canoe trips and visits to the beach. Milburn says, "Many of these kids live 2 miles from the beach but have never seen the ocean." His own experience has taught Milburn the importance of sharing his love of the outdoors. When the kids stand around him and learn about nature, they do not see his age or his race. They see his heart. And they know his heart understands them and the challenges they are facing because he is from the same type of place. People like Milburn, who serve as nature's ambassadors to young people and people of any age who are nature deprived, are heroes. The kids in his program learn how to appreciate and be good caretakers of nature. They experience firsthand the lessons nature has to teach us, how being outdoors benefits both our physical and mental health, and they carry these lessons with them throughout their lives. Levi Randolph attended the Academy Prep Center of Tampa, which has a partnership with Sierra Club's ICO program. While at Academy Prep, a private middle school designed to give bright children from low-income families top-notch educational opportunities, Randolph went on his very first camping trip, an outing led by Rocky Milburn. Now an adult, Randolph is an outings leader with the Tampa ICA group alongside Milburn. Randolph is paying forward his experience. He is pursuing a career working with animals and investing his time to make sure other kids from his old neighborhood and school get the same chance he had to explore and enjoy nature. This is a story that repeats itself in families and communities in every pocket of our country, and we should encourage and celebrate it. As someone who comes from a long line of outdoor enthusiasts who passed the love of nature on to me, I try to do the same for my kids. Whether we are skiing in the winter, paddling and fishing in the summer, or visiting national parks year-round, I try to do my part to make sure my family stays connected to the great outdoors. Everyone can do this, whether it's a community affair, a family affair, or both. Take, for example, Vidya Barnett, who is a disabled Air Force veteran. After Barnett suffered a minor stroke, it was reconnecting with the outdoors and her love of nature that gave her a renewed sense of purpose to get back on her feet. Just hearing the birds and feeling the sun on my face, it was like giving me life back, she says. Now Barnett works with Sierra Club's Military Outdoors campaign, getting other women veterans outdoors. She recounts one woman who left the service in the 1970s. This was the first time she felt like she was in community with veterans who looked like her. And I think it's important, even for veterans, to understand that all these lands are for us. They're for everybody. Barnett's mom, a Marine Corps veteran, has also gotten involved, bringing senior women veterans in their 70s out to enjoy the group's outings. This month is Earth Month. It is a perfect time to get outside. Bring your friends and family out there with you. If there is a local program near you that helps kids or anyone outside who doesn't typically have a lot of access to nature, consider chipping in your time. A love of nature is infectious, and it is one infection that is very worth spreading. Today's next main article, also from Magazine of the Sierra Club. This proposed law will be a boon for outdoor recreation. This was written by Lindsay Botts. If you've ever wanted to cycle long distances on public land, climb a rock face in a wilderness area, or know that your fourth grader will receive free admission to a national park, you're in luck. Congress is poised to pass a legislative package that combines more than a dozen bills designed to make it easier for people to access public lands, from national parks to national forests. The landmark bill is the Expanding Public Lands Outdoor Recreation Experiences, or the Explore Act. And supporters say leaders in Congress are closer than ever to bringing it to a floor vote, allowing it to become law. One of the surest signs of the Explore Act's chance of success is its bicameral and bipartisan sponsorship, with nearly an equal number of Democrats and Republicans co-sponsoring the proposed law. The Explore Act and a Senate version called the America's Outdoor Recreation Act have already sailed out of committee in both chambers, and a diverse array of outdoor recreation groups have stepped up to champion both bills' passage. Backers of the Explore Act include the American Mountain Guides Association, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation, and the Outdoor Industry Association. At REI Co-op, we believe time outside is fundamental to a life well lived, Taldi Harrison, the Director of Community and Government Affairs at REI Co-op, said in a press release in December when the Explore Act was introduced by 18 bipartisan sponsors. We applaud Chairman Bruce Westerman, Ranking Member Raul Grijalva, and the committee members for coming together to make the outdoors more accessible for everyone. Measures in the bill include requiring the federal agencies that manage public lands to restore defunct campsites, simplifying the permitting process for large group activities, and identifying new opportunities for recreation. In addition to outdoor groups, some conservation organizations have also spoken in favor of portions of the bill. There are barriers to families being able to safely or affordably access public lands. Some trails are inaccessible to people with mobility issues. Parks may not be within walking distance to certain neighborhoods. Or there are financial barriers. Rob Scott, the Deputy Director of Federal Policy with the Sierra Club's Outdoor for All campaign, said, "All communities deserve to enjoy nature and the outdoors. Legislation like the Explore Act will unlock opportunities for families nationwide." The Sierra Club and groups like the National Parks Conservation Association are especially excited about three proposed bills in the package. The first is the Outdoors for All Act, which would permanently authorize the Outdoor Recreation Legacy Partnership Program. Established during the Obama administration, the program offers cities matching grants to create green spaces in disadvantaged communities. The second is the Military Veterans in Parks Act, which would direct federal agencies to promote outdoor recreation among veterans, increase disability access to trails, and encourage the hiring of veterans for outdoor jobs. Another law in the combined legislation would extend the Every Kid Outdoors program, which allows all fourth graders and their families free admission to national parks for another 7 years. The Explore Act could not come at a better time. The outdoor recreation industry is one of the fastest growing economic sectors in the United States, increasing at roughly 5% annually. Nearly half of the country, 140 million people, visit public lands each year, pumping over $1 trillion into local economies. The Bureau of Land Management, which manages most national monuments, has seen a 35% increase in visitation from 2015 to 2022, according to the Center for American Progress. And over 300 million people have visited the national park system for 7 of the last 10 years. Spurred by this consistent raise in outdoor recreation, lawmakers have tried since 2019 to pass an outdoor recreation package. Americans' love for our public lands and spending time outdoors is growing every year, Arizona Democratic Representative Raul Grijalva, one of the bill's lead sponsors, said in a statement. The increasing popularity of outdoor recreation is a boon for local economies and job creation. But we must make sure our public land management agencies have the tools, resources, and staff they need to keep up. The Explore Act will help make getting outdoors not only easier, but also more enjoyable. One provision would encourage federal agencies to work with private businesses to help create housing and infrastructure in gateway towns near public lands and waters. One section would allow agencies to increase housing for federal employees near national parks. Another provision would require federal agencies to identify new trails and additional parking spots near high traffic areas. Some of the other provisions, however, have puzzled conservation groups. Such is the case with a proposed rule that would allow people to take hides and antlers from national park sites, and another that would require every Forest Service and BLM unit to have a shooting range. We do have some concerns about that bill in proximity to other recreation sites or proximity to national parklands, Tucker Johnson, the legislative program manager at the National Park Conservation Association, said. The bill was slightly modified to have some better language, but we still just, in general, don't love the idea of more firearms being on public lands adjacent to national parks. While the Explore Act is not a conservation bill that protects large swaths of land or protects endangered species, there's a lot to love in terms of the way it will expand access to public land. With the ever-rising crush of visitors only growing, this bill could offer a lifeline to areas that need investment. For the people who have advocated in support of the bill for years, its passage cannot come soon enough. This legislation will provide federal agencies with new tools they need to address recreation management and help more Americans reap the benefits of time spent outside, all while protecting the precious public lands and waters that make it all possible, Jessica Wall Turner, president of the Outdoor Recreation Roundtable, said in a statement. This is a much-needed and historic step forward. This article included an update at the end of it. On Tuesday, April 9th, the House passed the Expanding Public Lands Outdoor Recreation Experiences, or the Explore Act. House lawmakers are now urging their Senate colleagues to vote on a companion bill so that the two can be combined into one final text before heading to President Biden's desk to become law. For our next reading or two, we'll switch over to Mother Earth News, the original guide to living wisely. Our article, Territorial Space on Public Highways, Who Owns the Road? Written by Carlton Reed. Contrary to popular belief, it was not motorists who advocated for well-paved roads in the United States. In Roads Were Not Built for Cars, Red Kite Publishing, 2014, Carlton Reed shows how cyclists were the first to push for better roads and were also the pioneers of early motor cars. This excerpt, which discusses why cyclists and motorists have difficulty sharing the road, is from Chapter 4, titled Who Owns the Roads? Territorial Space on Public Highways. Social scientists theorize that humans believe in three kinds of territorial space. One is personal territory, like home. The second involves space that is only temporarily available, such as a gym locker. The third kind is public territory, such as roads. Territoriality is hardwired into our ancestors, believes Paul Bell, co-author of a study on road rage. Animals are territorial because it has survival value. If you could keep others away from your hunting groups, you had more game to spear. It becomes part of the biology. When they are on the road, some motorists forget they are in public territory because the cues surrounding them, personal music, fluffy dice, protective shells, suggest they are in private space. If you are in a vehicle that you identify as primary territory, you would defend that against other people whom you perceive as being disrespectful of your space, added Bell. What you ignore is that you are on a public roadway and you do not own the road. A standard quip from bicycle advocates aimed at a certain type of all mine motorists is, "You own a car, not the road." Some motorists insist it's cyclists who have the entitlement issues. "Cyclists think they own the roads," is a typical retort, common on forums and in local newspaper letters, pages the world over, but most especially in America, Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. In July 2014, Cortland Malloy, a columnist for the Washington Post, wrote in all seriousness that biker terrorists are out to rule the road. He later apologized. Who owns the road? Belief in road ownership, even if it is just the few meters in front and behind the road user, leads to disagreements. But probably what many motorists and cyclists would agree on is that roads are thoroughfares for travel. Pioneer motorists would amplify and expand the idea of roads being for transport only, but the transformation of the road's role was already well advanced by the time the first automobiles came along. The bicycle, the fastest vehicle on the road in the 1870s through to the mid-1890s, certainly played a part in redefining what a road was for. But apart from a smooth surface, the slim, single-track bicycle needed little in the way of built infrastructure. Trams, on the other hand, needed a great deal of dedicated space. With their rails and, once electrified, their overhead cables, trams very much transformed the concept of what roads were for, and that large parts of them could be appropriated for travel and travel alone. Later, motorists benefited from the land grab made by private tram companies. This was done by ripping out the rails put down at such great expense and replacing them with motor-centric asphalt, cooperating to ease its passage. In Europe, in the early 1900s, it was extremely difficult to drive between nation states. Motor cars had to be imported at every border and pay punitive duties in each country visited. Many countries required motorists to pass national driving tests. Automobile clubs, many of them founded as cycling clubs, lobbied hard to get such restrictions lifted. The lobbying took place at an international level and would quickly transform public highways into motoring roads. By 1908, just 12 years after Britain's Emancipation Act had legalized the use of motor cars, the officials at an international roads conference, many of them motorists, some of them former campaigning cyclists, took it upon themselves to define what roads were for. The Permanent International Association of Road Congresses excluded horse-drawn traffic from its remit at its first conference, held in Paris in 1908. The Permanent International Association of Road Congresses delegates started to exclude cycling traffic from its work at the Congress held in Brussels in 1910. At the London Conference held in 1913, cycling was removed completely. Roads, decided the Permanent International Association of Road Congresses, delegates were only for A to B travel propelled by motors. There were only 105,700 motor cars in use in Britain in 1913, yet they had already driven many traditional users off the road. The right of the pedestrian to use the King's Highway is one of the most valuable and cherished public possessions, wrote rambler and rights-of-way expert G.H.B. Ward in a 1913 pamphlet. Notwithstanding the legal rights of the pedestrian to the full and free use of any part of the King's Highway, the modern multitude of motor cars have, to all intents and purposes, driven him off the main trunk, county, and interurban roads. The legacy of the Permanent International Association of Road Congress's decision in 1913 is still with us. Roads are deemed to be motor thoroughfares. Those without motors may be granted access, perhaps, but only under sufferance and only under strict motor-centric conditions. Cyclists must ride in the gutter. Pedestrians must stay on the sidewalk. That is, if one is provided. And if one is not, that's a motor-only road. And both shall interact with motorists only at designated crossing points, which are usually far apart, mitigating against those without motors, but smoothing the traffic flow, the transportation wonk term for squeezing as many motor vehicles through a junction as possible. And do not expect to cross anytime soon. British and American traffic planners clearly believe roads are for cars, and pesky pedestrians and cranky cyclists can damn well wait. And today's final reading comes to us also from Mother Earth News and is in a common subject as the previous article. Biking for transportation. Dust off your bike and start enjoying the fresh air. Written by Ingrid Butler. I first learned about biking for transportation when I visited my grandparents in Germany more than a decade ago. They lived in the countryside where you'd often walk past or through small family farms to get where you were going, and at any given point in the summer, you had to watch out for horse apples on the smaller roads. My grandmother used to collect this free fertilizer and use it in her garden. A family friend offered to take me, via bike, to a town near Lake Constance, also known as the Bodensee in German, which borders southern Germany, Switzerland, and Austria. The trip was only 10 kilometers, about 4.5 miles, but involved a route that I was certainly not prepared for. Reader, it was largely uphill. In all her enthusiasm about showing me the beautiful German countryside, my friend had wanted to take me along the scenic route and had drastically overestimated my abilities. I had to walk my bike uphill for the last quarter of the trip, and we decided to take a more level route home. Despite the agonizingly sore muscles the next day and the next week, I was intrigued by the idea that the bike was not just something you played with in the neighborhood as a kid, but rather it was a tool that could help you move from one place to the next under your own power. Now, one of my favorite modes of transportation is biking. I love biking down to the library or to the local parks. My area is slowly becoming more inclusive and mindful of cyclists and the necessary infrastructure to support them. If you're able to, consider biking down to a place you'd normally drive. Here's how to get started, whether you have a spare bike in the garage or you're looking for a new ride. Know what to check for in a used bike can save you time and money down the road. Many aspects of bike maintenance can be done yourself. Bike baskets and other cycling equipment are handy for helping you transport goods and groceries. Invest in a sturdy and reliable bike lock to keep your ride safe. Try your hand at constructing a do-it-yourself bike cargo trailer. In Tips for Buying a Used Bike, adapted from the Urban Biking Handbook, Quarry Books, 2011, Charles Hain offers guidance to help you find a used bike that's perfect for your needs. He recommends a careful examination of the bike frame for any dents, cracks, or damage. Check out the brakes and make sure that both the front and back brakes work. Take a test ride of the bike to make sure it's something you can work with, and ride a variety of bikes before you make a purchase to learn what you prefer. Lastly, know how to identify a stolen bike. An expensive bike being sold cheaply is a warning sign. Dave Gloas provides some troubleshooting tips for common bike problems. Check that the wheels are free of debris and scan for any damage to the tire. A small screwdriver can help remove glass or other embedded materials in the tire if necessary. Make sure the tires are inflated to the correct pressure. The wheel will also need to spin freely without making contact with either brake pad or the frame. If it does, adjust the wheel by loosening the axle nuts or quick-release lever and then repositioning the wheel. For more tips, see Bike Maintenance, What to Check Before Riding, adapted from Urban Bikers Tricks and Tips, WordSpace Press, 2010. Having a bike basket can make your ride much more productive and conducive to the flow of modern life. in bike basket options and alternatives adapted from Everyday Bicycling Cantankerous Titles 2012, Ellie Blue goes through the variety of bike baskets and other cycling equipment and shows how to determine what equipment is best for your needs. A front basket is a classic, but did you know about bike panniers? Blue goes over the uses of bungee cords, rear baskets, front baskets, tie-downs, backpacks, and even the humble plastic milk crate. Also, find instructions for a do-it-yourself bike basket if you're feeling extra thrifty. Brad Quartuccio shares his tips for keeping your ride from being stolen. He discusses the various bike locks available on the market, U-locks, bike chains, and cables. Invest in a sturdy lock. Remember, your bike is only as safe as your lock and locking technique. He recommends locking the frame to a secure post. A chain link fence or signpost may not deter determined thieves. Don't lock a U-lock or bike chain so that it hangs on the ground, and if possible, completely avoid cable locks, as they're easily cut. Lock your wheels as well. You don't want to come back to have a one-wheeled bike. Lastly, if you're feeling handy and particularly inventive, a do-it-yourself bike cargo trailer might be the next step in your cycling journey. Kyle Chandler Isaacson details how he built one in only 10 hours and for one-fifth of what it would cost to buy new. Using a mix of salvage and new materials, he created a cargo trailer perfect for hauling heavier loads. Give his journey a read. You never know what it might inspire you to build for your bike. That's all the time we have for the April 17th reading of The Environment. Thank you for joining us. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org. or by calling 303-786-7777.